From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners just like you, and we are so grateful. Please visit stateofbelief.com and help keep this show on the air. The explosive situation in Ukraine, cuts in America's defense budget, and fasting for family values. Here's what's coming up in the next hour on State of Belief Radio.
As we end our combat mission in Afghanistan, this will be the first budget to fully reflect the transition DOD is making for after 13 years of war.
Devastating cuts to our military. Could this move by the Obama administration now put your security at risk?
Last month, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel proposed significant cuts to funding for the nation's military. With unrest in many parts of the world, is this an appropriate time for such reductions? Some will say there's never an appropriate time. But others contend that we desperately need to reallocate our resources away from war-making. And on this week's show, I'll talk with Jim Kaysen of the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker lobby for peace and justice.
We faith leaders will continue to work every single day until not one more family separated or devastated by the broken immigration policies of this country.
Have you noticed how when justice issues reach a critical mass in this country, whether it's civil rights, the social safety net, or labor, faith leaders are at the forefront of positive change? More and more, it looks like we're at another such moment today. And among the leaders most deeply involved in the key justice issues of our time is Bishop Minerva Carcano of Los Angeles. On this week's show, she's back with us to talk about her tireless, faith-driven activism for immigration reform and marriage equality.
It's been nearly a decade-long struggle here between Ukraine turning east to Russia or west to Europe.
In the fight for Ukraine's future, protesters lobbying rocks and Molotov cocktails. The police retaliating with rubber bullets, stun grenades, and reportedly live ammunition.
Far-right activists are becoming more and more vocal in Ukraine and are central to the violence.
Personally, I cannot be part of a network funded by the Russian government that whitewashes the actions of Putin. And that is why, after this newscast, I'm resigning.
When the Euromaidan protests began in Ukraine back in November, Valdas Davidanis was living and working in Kiev. As the situation has deteriorated to what is now a de facto Russian takeover of parts of that country, we'll cut through the conflicting reports that typically reach us here in the West with his first-person look at the situation. But first,
brink of war. Russian forces take Crimea. Parliament authorizes a strike on Ukraine. With the world on high alert, will Vladimir Putin expand his invasion?
As we struggle to come to terms with the looming possibility of a new Cold War with Russia, it's vital to understand the motivating forces behind what, at least on the surface, may appear to be irrational action on the part of that country's leaders. Presenting an articulate explanation, as she so often does, is the Reverend Dr. Susan Brooks Thistlewaite, writing in the Huffington Post in an article headlined, "Putin's Holy Russia Goes to War." She lays out the context of recent events as clearly as anyone I've seen. Susan writes that, quote, "When religion is being used to fuel nationalistic fervor as it is today in Russia, the aggression is actually perfectly credible from the point of view of the aggressor." Here to explain is Susan Thistlewaite. Susan, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Oh, thank you, Welton, and thank you for having me. It is crucial to look at the religion factor in international affairs. There's the idea that religion is about human rights, right? Mm-hmm. Religious freedom and human rights. And if listeners don't take anything else away from this, take this. Religion around the world is about identity. It is not primarily conceived of as rights. It is conceived of as identity and national identity. And it is also conceived of as identity in certain parts of religious America. So just get that. And then you can begin to see why Vladimir Putin is hanging out with Russian Orthodox patriarchs. I believe that our folks in international affairs don't get how significant that was, that Putin started to make that move.
Does John Kerry know that?
I can't speak for John Kerry. I got to know Secretary Madeleine Albright. Mm-hmm. When Secretary Albright first put this thesis out that the State Department, they missed religion, mm-hmm.
right?
In what was happening in Iran. It wasn't on their radar screen. And that was a serious mistake. I looked around the room when she first argued that thesis, mm-hmm. and some of the people in the foreign policy establishment looked like she had just set her hair on fire. I mean, they were like, what do you mean, religion?
Yeah.
And I think that even today, now people kind of have gotten the clue that we've got to pay attention to Islam, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I think that point has been made, though often it is a very poor and not well nuanced and historically situated mm-hmm. understanding of Islam. But, you know, this is Russian Orthodoxy. Why should that send an alarm signal through the U.S. foreign policy establishment? Well, I think if they had been paying attention, they would have realized that Putin is trying to retrieve this Holy Russia symbolism to aggregate his own power. And remember, I said, religion and identity, right?
Yeah.
He's trying to form a nationalist identity. He uses religion to do that. Maybe, you know, I'm speculating. I don't have these folks' ear, but I just do know Washington a little bit. Religion is instrumentalized. It's extraneous a lot of the time to the analysis. And I'm saying if Putin thinks that he's going to get moral authority from the Russian Orthodox, you see the pictures of him hanging out with the patriarchs, right? Then what we in the West need is to, yes, I think the sanctions are a good idea. I think all those traditional foreign policy moves are the right thing to do. But you need to get at the moral force. You've got to find other religious leaders, and it's not me in the United Church of Christ. Putin is going to pay no attention to me. Mm-hmm. But to get other moral authorities around the world to counter this.
If we paid attention to what is really going on, that would be the strategy.
I think so. I think so. And I've certainly heard back from even people in Washington who were saying, yeah, good idea.
Mm-hmm.
So we also didn't pay enough attention to this murderous, rising homophobic ideology.
Yes.
And we didn't pay enough attention to the fact that he was also attacking feminists like Pussy Riot.
Okay, connect those two, Susan, because, I mean, we're talking about moral authority on the one hand, and then we're talking about this immoral kind of reaction to homosexuals and their rights.
Yeah, but, well, to me and to you, people who have respect for equal human rights, but how often is a militant homophobia, you know, let's look at Arizona, okay?
Yeah.
The Arizona discriminatory legislation against gay people that you don't have to serve them, right?
Yeah.
What is that bill called? Religious Freedom Bill, right?
Oh, yeah.
That's, you know, in this funhouse world, discriminating against homosexuals is being moral.
Mm-hmm.
It's true in Arizona, and it's true in Moscow.
Yeah.
Thank heavens there is an advance in gay rights. But as yet, I think people don't see how much this rising homophobia in Russia is an attempt on Putin's part to demonstrate his moral force.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we have to say just what you said. That's not moral force. That's immoral, right?
Well, and I just find it so significant that as you see a Western leaders are thinking that a religious lens is now an outdated way of analyzing what's happening in places like Russia when, in fact, this is a very contemporary frame. But where else is that happening in the world?
Let's look at conflict in Nigeria.
Uh-huh.
I mean, here you have what is, again, a lot of economic turmoil and turmoil, again, about oil. And, you know, we can cut through all of this, Welton, and say, really, all of this doesn't matter because a pipeline goes through the U.K. You know, I mean, it's about oil. At the end of the day, it's about oil. But I don't think that means that either in Nigeria, and certainly Christian and Muslim conflict in Nigeria is reached, you know, epidemic proportions.
Yeah.
But that's the point I was trying to make in this column. And again, John Kerry says, and I respect the man, but he's wrong. He said this is 19th century behavior in the 21st century. No, it's not, Mr. Kerry. This is 21st century conflict. This is how 21st century conflict becomes accelerated and fueled by issues of religious identity. And if you keep ignoring religion, you will not see this freight train coming at you.
Yeah.
And that, more than anything else, is something I can get concerned about, because you want our foreign policy to be as shrewd and with as much foresight as possible in order to reduce conflict.
Sure.
Right? And yet, I mean, I was startled by that phrase. It's 19th century in the 21st century. And that made me think you are just not paying attention to 21st century conflict, because there's virtually no part of the world where some form of religion is not implicated in conflict.
Russia, people who have been there and studied it say that voices from the religious right in the United States have been feeding that prejudice that's there. We know that's happened in Uganda. We really are looking in the mirror. They could have got it from us. The whole movement was to religiify politics.
This is our toxic stew of religious identity, racism, homophobia, in this cocktail of conservative politics. We do export religious intolerance, we export homophobia, we export anti-feminism along with these conservative religious ideologies. But if you want to understand conflict in the 21st century, I am saying you've got to understand religion is now a crucial factor in national identity.
The Reverend Dr. Susan Brooks Thistlewaite is professor of theology at Chicago Theological Seminary and the author of the book, Dreaming of Eden, American Religion and Politics in a Wired World. Susan's invaluable article titled Putin's Holy Russia Goes to War appeared this week on the Huffington Post, and we'll link to it at stateofbelief.com. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Welton, for helping me even think about this more, as you did in this interview. I appreciate it.
As we look at the ongoing crisis in Ukraine, it's really impossible to avoid the conflicting narratives. Many say that pro-EU freedom fighters were brutally attacked by Russian-backed authorities, leading to a land grab by Vladimir Putin. Others say that we witnessed a rise to power held back by Russia's humanitarian intervention. Fortunately, we have friends on the ground in Ukraine, and I'm now joined by Valdis Dovydėnas, a Lithuanian native who has lived and worked in Kyiv for the past 9 years as a consultant on transportation and customs. Valdis, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Hello.
What is it like for you to be living in Kyiv at this point since the protests began?
I can see only that it became more dangerous in Ukraine, but from other side, now after the revolution, I think that people are maybe more happy, because they are feeling that the big changes are coming, and they're hoping that for their country will go really better than it was before during Yanukovych.
Are they thinking that because of the occupation from Russia, or are they thinking that because of their own choice of a leader?
Occupation by Russia in Crimea, I think it's very, very sad thing, because Russia has occupied fully Crimea, and there are lots of Ukrainians living in Crimea, not only Russians, but Tatars, Ukrainians. And I think everybody are really afraid for those people who are staying in Crimea currently. From other side, everybody still believes that there is possibility that maybe this conflict will be solved on diplomatic ways, not fighting without war. So people are feeling from one side, feeling hope, from another side, they're really afraid of what is happening in Crimea. And here in Kiev, people are waiting for changes from the new government.
Valdis, do they want Russian soldiers to go home?
Oh, yes, of course. In Ukraine, we have lots of Russians, native Russians, even in Kiev, lots of people who say that they are Ukrainians. But at home and at work, they speak only Russian language. I think they are really Russians, but they are living in Ukraine, and they said that they are Ukrainians and want to live in Ukraine, but not in Russia. And what is currently doing Russia in Crimea, it's really occupation, it's invasion.
Do you have a fear of violence if the Russians don't leave soon?
I hope that it will not happen, because nothing can be as bad as a war.
Yes. You personally grew up in Soviet-occupied Lithuania. How does that affect the way you see what's happening today in Ukraine?
Okay, from my side, I think it's what is currently happening in Ukraine, it's that they are doing the same as Nazis have done in 1936, or Soviet Union has done with Lithuania and Baltic states in 1940s. They're just coming to protect Russian people from themselves. And after they're making, with the guns, people to vote for joining currently Russia before it was Soviet Union, I think it's the same play.
When you look at the West's news coverage of Ukraine and what's happening, what do you think are the most important aspects of the story that we're not seeing or hearing? They're not being reported enough.
To be honest, I'm not very familiar with what news you are getting in the States. Okay. But I know that Russia has really big propaganda machine, and it's what I'm seeing here from Russian channels. It's really black lies and propaganda showing that everybody in Ukraine are fascists except those who are for the Russians.
Hmm.
To be honest, even my parents from Lithuania are calling me and saying that when we are watching Russian TV, it seems to us that everybody in Ukraine, except Nazis, want to be a part of Russia. And that is really lies. Because I don't think that even those Russians who are living in Ukraine want to be a part of Russia. Because lots and lots of Russians were participating in Maidan. Lots and lots of Jewish, Tatar, Georgians, and other nations were participating in Maidan, and they were fighting not to join Russia, but against corrupted Yanukovych.
Valdis, you have an opportunity to speak to at least a part of the people in America. What do you want to tell us Americans about what we should be thinking and feeling regarding Ukraine?
I think that now everybody must pray that there will be no war in Ukraine. And I hope that American people will support all those democratic changes that are coming to Ukraine. And, okay, not only states, but all the world will support. Because what is happening currently in Crimea, it's really terrible.
Valdas Davidanas has lived and worked in Ukraine for the past 9 years. He is speaking to us today from Kiev. Valdas, I cannot thank you enough for being with us on State of Belief Radio, and I want you to know you are not alone. There are people here who care very much about what's happening to you, and we join you in prayers that there will be no violence.
I hope for that very, very much.
When Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel proposed significant cuts to the nation's military budget, there were predictable howls of protests from politicians like Senator John McCain. Still, many are saying Hagel's budget doesn't go far enough. Joining me right now is Jim Kaysen, Associate Executive Secretary for Strategic Advocacy at the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker lobby in the public interest. Jim, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Welton, thank you so much for giving us this opportunity to have a conversation with you today.
Would you start with just a very quick overview of the massive work of FCNL?
We are a 70-year-old lobby, as you said, founded by the Quakers to bring Quaker values to Washington. We have a prophetic vision of the world that we seek. We're not trying to make Congress into a Quaker organization, but we do believe that some of those values could inform public policy. And we've been effective in a range of issues, from playing an important role in the founding of the Peace Corps and the Arms Control Disarmament Agency, to more recently helping to mobilize the U.S. government to respond to the war in the Central African Republic, and working, as you might expect, for a nonviolent answer to the issue of chemical weapons in Syria.
I want to look specifically at what you co-wrote after the Hagel proposal. It was an article headlined, "Wars Are Ending. Why Does the Pentagon Want More Money?"
My colleague Tila Neguse and I wrote that piece because what we saw happening here in Washington didn't match either what was necessary for the federal government or the values of the organization that we work for. We've seen in the last few years Pentagon spending come down, as you made a reference, compared to the record increase in Pentagon spending over the last 15 years. And that's an important step. As the war in Iraq ended, as the U.S. war in Afghanistan is coming to a close, I think the American people would expect that the U.S. would spend more on our domestic priorities and put less into putting men and women overseas in conflict situations. What we saw from Secretary Hagel was not that. What we saw was a proposal to increase Pentagon spending. Our organization believes that the federal government has to keep faith with the men and women who were put in danger, the members of the military who were sent overseas and have come back wounded or hurt in any kind of way. And so we always support funding for our veterans and for other troops that have been put in danger. But we don't believe the U.S. should be putting new troops in danger, and we don't believe that at this moment in time, the U.S. should be increasing the Pentagon budget again. And yet, that's what President Obama and Secretary Hagel have proposed. They've proposed that in this coming year, there'll be a core Pentagon budget, and then there'll be, in effect, a discretionary budget of some $80 billion that we're actually calling a slush fund, because they haven't even determined what they're going to put in it. They've just said, we needed this extra money. And then the president has suggested that Pentagon spending needs to go up again in the 4 years following this next year. And we see that as a mistake. It doesn't obviously comport with our own values. We're an organization that believes war is not the answer, but we also don't think it's good public policy.
Right.
When you look at what happened at the end of the Cold War, what happened at the end of Vietnam, Pentagon spending came down very dramatically. Right now, with these proposals that the President and Secretary Hagel have proposed, Pentagon spending will remain, in inflation-adjusted terms, at the same level as it was at the height of the Cold War. And to us, that doesn't make sense when there's so many other pressing domestic priorities.
I want you to talk a little more about the moral aspects of this, because they are equally important.
Of course, our participation in this conversation in Capitol Hill comes out of Friends, Faith, and Practice. We're a peace church and a community that takes the biblical injunction to work with everyone and work for peace to heart. We're a community that believes that nonviolence is the way and is more powerful than violence. And we're a community that believes war is not the answer. We don't believe that the federal government should become Quaker. We do believe that it would be good public policy for the United States to invest more money in preventing wars instead of engaging in new military conflicts. And interestingly enough, if you look at our military leaders, retiring Secretary Gates did not believe the U.S. would be involved in another big land war. So I think there's a movement to recognize that the results of the U.S. invasion of Iraq and even the results of the invasion of Afghanistan were not what people expected, and that people are searching for a different way. And interestingly, we're finding members of the military, people in the State Department who are coming to us and saying, well, when we look at what the U.S. government spends on foreign engagement, when you count everything from the military to diplomacy to foreign aid, 90 to 95% of that entire budget goes towards the military and force. And lots of people are beginning to say, you know, the U.S. could be more responsible in the way it spends money and could also work more for peace to prevent violent conflicts before they happen.
Mm-hmm.
I think we really have to look at this idea that the U.S. is somehow the world policeman.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that the U.S. is in a position where it can solve everything that's wrong in the world today. I would like it to, and my heart hurts when I think that the U.S. doesn't have the answer for every problem in the world. But I think that we as a nation would do well to try and work with other communities. So, for instance, our organization is working with Muslim leaders and Christian leaders in the Central African Republic to say we don't necessarily, as Americans, have the answer to what's happening there, but we can work with other people of faith who are working together to try and devise answers that will bring people together rather than pulling them apart.
Jim, what do you say about people saying that with a new aggressive Russia as well as other trouble spots around the globe, we just can't afford to cut any part of our military? It's going to leave us defenseless.
What I say in response to that question pretty regularly now is, what will more nuclear weapons buy us? We have in our nuclear arsenal right now 1,500 nuclear weapons, many more than the number we need to destroy Russia, more than we need to destroy the entire world. The Russian government also has control of a similar number of nuclear weapons, many more than needed to destroy the world. There's a level at which, and President Obama has proposed this, both countries could reduce their nuclear arsenals by about a third and still have many more than they needed to destroy each other. And nobody that I've heard believes that the answer in the Ukraine is going to be a U.S. land invasion of the Ukraine or of Russia.
Mm-hmm.
What we're hearing is that the U.S. needs to work with its allies, work with the Germans, work with the French on international solutions that might involve putting international peacekeepers into the Ukraine or something on that kind of order. I'm not endorsing any of those proposals, but I am saying those are the kinds of proposals. Those are not proposals that need an F-35 jet fighter. Those are not proposals that need a literal combat ship. We're in the United States right now, we're building weapons that have no objective other than, and I think this is the import of people who ask that question, to show that we have more force than the other guy. But in this day and age, having a faster jet fighter than the other guy, that's not the way the U.S. is fighting wars anymore. We come at this first from a matter of moral principle. But as a matter of public policy, it doesn't make sense to spend, you know, the estimated life cost of the F-35 program is over $1 trillion. To spend $1 trillion on a jet airplane for an enemy that doesn't exist, that doesn't make sense. It does make sense to invest in cooperative international action. It does make sense to invest in the United Nations. It does make sense to invest in diplomacy to try and address some of these problems. And while we as a Quaker organization might say it doesn't make sense to spend anything on the Pentagon because we don't see the Pentagon as having a value there, others could say, well, you could invest some in the Pentagon, but certainly not at the levels that we're talking about. Because nobody believes that by buying F-35 jet fighters, that's going to prevent the leader of Russia from occupying the Crimea.
Please tell our listeners how they can help in calling for a responsible military budget.
I would encourage all of our listeners, and honestly, this is what I hear when I go into congressional offices, to be in touch with your elected representatives. There are a lot of hardworking members of Congress here in Washington who want to do the right thing, who believe that the Pentagon budget is too high. But in some sense, they're concerned that the public will not support them in that because of this narrative that's developing that, well, in an era with Al-Qaeda and now with what's happening in Russia and Syria, the answer to those problems is just to invest more in the military. We would say the answer to those problems is to figure out how to have a shared security framework, a smart security framework that doesn't mean just pouring more and more money into this, but means figuring out what are the solutions that will get the chemical weapons out of Syria, which, by the way, they are coming out of Syria. What are the solutions that will finally address the violence in the Central African Republic? What is the cooperative international response to what Russia has done in the Ukraine that will dial down this conflict and ultimately lead to some kind of solution? And I would encourage people first to communicate with their elected representatives. Communicate with your senators and your representatives. We have tools on our website that you can certainly go to, Friends Committee on National Legislation. And our web address is fcnl.org, or you can just Google Quaker Lobby. Right on the front, there are easy ways to send a message. But you don't need to use our organization to do that. You can also call the local office of your elected officials and say, you know, I'm concerned that the budget that has just come out puts more money back into the Pentagon, and I don't think that's a good use of resources, and I'd like to hear more. In our way of thinking as the Friends Committee on National Legislation, we encourage people to call up their members of Congress and ask questions, not to go in with declarative statements, because many members of Congress are very smart people who are interested in hearing what their constituents have to say and know a lot about these issues as well. And I think you'll find that your elected officials are receptive to that. The Quaker community has a saying, the light of God exists in everyone. And as you approach a member of Congress, whether you agree with them or not, or a congressional staff, look for the light of God in that other person and see if you can find the place where you might have some common principles that you can build on to try and figure out how we can craft U.S. government policies that can meet the needs of the whole nation, not simply keep pouring money into the Pentagon, which we've done for far too long.
Jim Kaysen is Associate Executive Secretary for Strategic Advocacy at the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker lobby in the public interest. Jim, I really thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio and encourage you and your colleagues there to keep up the good work.
Welton, thank you so much for the opportunity to talk with you and with all of your listeners.
We last spoke to Los Angeles United Methodist Bishop Minerva Carcano last summer. Last March, she met with President Obama on the issue, and just last month, the bishop was among those arrested during an immigration pray-in for President's Day. The first Hispanic woman to be elected to the Episcopacy of the United Methodist Church, Bishop Carcano serves the Los Angeles area and is a leader in the denomination's work on immigration. Bishop Carcano, I am so glad you're with us again today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. It's my privilege.
Where do you think things stand, and have things changed at all since we spoke last summer?
I don't believe that things have changed. In fact, I think they've worsened. I think we're at a place where principle has been lost. So we have a conversation between a president and a Congress that can't move us ahead. They're playing politics and forgetting that they are dealing with the lives of men, women, young people, and children. So I'm very concerned, as are many thousands of faith leaders across the country and others of just heart.
So what is the focus of your activism right now?
It has two sides to it. One of them is, of course, to continue pressing for comprehensive immigration reform. I have yet to see a comprehensive immigration reform bill before us. What the Senate did does not get us there. The Republicans in Congress and the House are stuck in holding back any furthering of the conversation. And so, of course, I join persons like those involved in the Fast for Families across the country to continue to push for comprehensive immigration reform. But more pressing for me and for others at this moment is to stop the deportations. In a few weeks, President Obama's administration will have deported about 2 million people. 2 million people. 2 million people whose lives affect many, many others because they're part of a family, they're part of a neighborhood, a community, a church, a mosque, a synagogue. And you can exponentially begin to calculate the numbers of lives that have been affected, devastated, hurt, broken. And so I'm also focusing on stopping the deportations, which is what we were doing 2 weeks ago in Washington, D.C., in that pray-in, hoping and praying that President Obama's heart would be touched by God, not by us, but by God, to stop the deportations.
Do you get a sense, Bishop, that the White House is in touch with the tragedies that are going on that you've just described and sense the urgency of action on this issue?
Only in a limited way. I am encouraged when I hear, for example, that a few weeks ago, President Obama, Mrs. Obama, and others from his staff visited hunger strikers, people on a fast. It's more than a hunger strike. It's a fast of prayer. People who are fasting all across this country, myself included. He visited a group of those who were fasting in San Francisco and said, "We hear you. We are with you." In those moments, I think he gets in touch. But he goes back to D.C. and loses touch rather quickly. I'm concerned that the consistency of his leadership around immigration has just not been there. Mm-hmm. I remember DACA, when he came forward and with great authority and great commitment signed DACA. But he was on the campaign trail. He was trying to gain some votes. Mm-hmm. And then that was it. And so I'm very concerned about our president's inability to lead us on immigration reform. Not only that, his strategy is wrong. His strategy is to prove to the Republicans that he can be trusted to create security in this country and thus the deportation of the 2 million, so that the Republicans trust him and come to the table for conversation around immigration reform. That's not going to happen. That's not going to happen because there's not moral judgment or courage in the Republican Congress, not enough strength in Congress, period, in the House of Representatives. There's not trust for President Obama. Racism is at the heart of that as well. And so it's a bad strategy.
You and I have spoken previously about the significance of fasting as a part of praying for change. You and I, as Christians, this past week, put ashes on our head to enter the season of Lent, traditionally associated with fasting. How can we make a connection for people who don't understand? How can we make a connection between the discipline of fasting and our desire for change on immigration?
Fasting is at its heart setting aside the time that we would normally be consuming food in order to focus on something else. And in the Christian faith, we focus on prayer. We focus on our relationship with God and our relationship with neighbor, with others. And so the fasting that I'm participating in is a fasting of focusing on praying for immigrant families, setting aside that time when I would be consumed by food, literally focused on food. I set aside that time to allow my spirit to be consumed by thoughts of our immigrant brothers and sisters, lifting up prayers for them, but also considering what else must I do to be a just person of justice, a person who stands with those who are on the margins, just as Jesus stood with those on the margins. It's about making space in our lives for correcting our brokenness and correcting the brokenness in society as well, all those places where injustice rules.
Should our listeners keep doing what they always do about writing letters, that kind of thing, or is there something new that needs to be done from the grassroots?
I believe that they should keep calling in and writing those letters, but I would encourage them to join the program that's called Fast for Families. It's online, easy to find, easy to become a part of. They could show up for those visits to congressional offices that are happening all over the country with these leaders for Fast for Families. I also want to hold up the opportunity to be in prayer, very importantly, on April the 3rd through the 6th. Create a prayer time, just individuals, two or three, a whole congregation, out at a park with friends, wherever they can do that, wherever we can join to be in prayer for comprehensive immigration reform and for the stopping of the deportation.
Bishop Carcano, I know that out of the breadth of your compassion, you recently wrote an open letter to African bishops on the issue of LGBT rights. What role do you envision for African faith leaders in the face of increasingly institutionalized homophobia there?
I expect all of us to stand for the sacred worth of all individuals, be they gay or not, be they heterosexual or homosexual. It is institutional homophobia, but it's also institutional violence. It's one thing to be homophobic and think that way. It's another thing to actively act out that rejection of a person because of their sexual orientation. And that's what happens all over the world, and it's happening in a very particularly acute way in Africa, as seen in Uganda. And so my prayer is that our United Methodist bishops in Africa would stand and speak a word of standing with the homosexual person and protecting their sacred worth, protecting them from violence, not allowing this institutionalization of violence and homophobia to continue to persist. Our African United Methodists have not been there. They claim that spot for themselves. They're not there with us on being an inclusive church for everyone, including homosexuals. But regardless of that, they should be there. We should all be there to protect human life.
I know that recently you invited the Reverend Frank Schaefer to join your conference after he was removed from ministry in Pennsylvania. Would you talk just briefly about the civil rights precedents for this kind of action?
Yes, in the 60s, when the civil rights movement was at its greatest force, there were Methodist pastors in the South who stood against segregation, who stood in support of African American brothers and sisters and were ostracized by their Methodist churches and set aside by the Methodist bishops in that area. And Bishop Gerald Kennedy, who happened to be serving here in the Los Angeles area, began to invite them, and 17 of them came. And so I was moved by that. We just celebrated last year the 50th anniversary of Bishop Gerald Kennedy's historic step, historic stand. And as I prayed about Frank Schaefer, for he represents a condition in our church, his situation represents a condition in our church, I felt in prayer moved to invite him. I did not do that unilaterally. I called his own bishop, Bishop Peggy Johnson, and she and I spoke together, prayed together. She encouraged me to invite him, felt that while he did not have a space for ministry there in Pennsylvania, he might have an opportunity here. She affirmed his ability to be an effective minister. And so we are in that ongoing work of bringing him to California.
When you look at your church, when you look at the Church Universal, I would say, you think the church will move on same-gender marriage anytime soon?
I regret to say that I think it'll move because society will move, because society will change. And it saddens me that we will follow rather than lead. I believe God expects us to lead into a world of justice for all God's children.
Bishop Minerva Carcano is a prominent faith leader on issues of justice, including immigration and LGBT issues. She heads the United Methodist Los Angeles Episcopal Area. Bishop Carcano, it is always an honor and a pleasure to be with you.
You're very kind, and I'm grateful, and I welcome the ongoing conversation for the sake of justice and the sake of all God's children. God bless you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. I'm kind of breathless. These were terrific guests with insights that we really needed. I know I really needed. Your generous support is essential in bringing to the public the kind of show we've done today. Please visit stateofbelief.com and consider making a contribution today. We'll use it wisely to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program. Every week, literally every week, we hear from listeners across the country who say they rely on our show for the kind of inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue they can't find anywhere else. Stateofbelief.com is where you'll find out more about our show, hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. I hope you'll stay in touch with us throughout the week on Facebook and Twitter. The listener line for State of Belief Radio is 202-681-4246. Of course, we want you to tell others about this show and encourage them to be listeners also. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.